Well, for Pacific women, some of the pressing issues are, of course, violence against women and girls. The statistics of violence against women and girls are some of the highest globally. We have the lowest representation of women in parliament and legislature. So, you know, some countries have no women at all, some countries have 1 to 2, and we need to increase that representation. We also have issue with land, land rights. There are some countries where women cannot own land at all, and this has a huge barrier on her economic empowerment.
What do you see from the government side is being done specifically to deal with these issues?
Well, you know, being here at the Commission on the Status of Women has really lifted the profile of, because, you know, Pacific governments never really came to the Commission on the Status of Women. Previously, those governments who did come would only come for the first few days of CSW, present their statements and then return home. It was not a norm for Pacific governments to stay on for negotiations, apart from Australia and New Zealand. And over the last 6 to 7 years, Pacific governments have becoming more proactive in staying on for negotiations. They're becoming more proactive in following up on the statements that they make yearly, and you know what they've promised, to how they've promised to better the lives of women and girls. So in that sense, I think, you know, CSW is such a huge international space, but at the same time, it really does encourage our governments to increase their political will in terms of achieving gender equality in each of our Pacific Island countries.
Now, you mentioned in this discussion the human rights framework that you're using in the Tonga Women and Children Crisis Centre. Could you please tell me more about this?
Yeah, you know, the human rights framework is really, it places the victim as the central focus for our services. So we place high importance and give priority to her story. So whatever she's come in to tell us and to share with us, that dictates our entire work. So, you know, we're, from her story, we're able to highlight where the human rights rights violations are. So, for example, you know, in her story, she could be sharing that this is, you know, she's lived through 30 years of violence and abuse, and this is her first time seeking help. And, you know, through that story, we're able to find out, why did it take her so long? Why did it take her 30 years to get to the centre and seek services? You know, there are cultural barriers. She might have attempted to go to her local police station 3 or 4 or 5 times, and she's given up. Because, you know, the police officer could be related to her husband. So that's why the story is so critical to us, because we then see exactly where all the agencies, the government, private sector and NGOs have failed the victim. So because we don't ask those questions, we don't probe her further, we don't offer her services, we don't offer her a safe space to tell her story, we fail her in so many ways. And so that's why it's critical for us to use the human rights framework, because as soon as someone walks through the door, we want to ensure that her story is valued, and that, you know, everything that we could possibly offer her within our means is offered.
How can the human rights framework be implemented?
You know, I think it's a joint partnership between all the key agencies. Key staff need to be trained, senior management, you know, those making the key decision within those key institutions and agencies all need to understand what the human rights framework is, so that we all work collaboratively and we all work speaking the same language, and we all put the victim at the centre of the framework, and we assist her to empower herself in deciding what her roadmap is.